Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The history of the Balkans is replete with stories of ethnic violence and attempted genocide. No one familiar with that history should be surprised at recent developments in that part of the world. But perhaps we need to review the history, at least in the period since the collapse of the Iron Curtain. We'll do that in today's show. But before, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1860, one of America's fabled endeavors was inaugurated, the Pony Express, promising to deliver mail between St. Joseph, Missouri and Sacramento, California in about 10 days. The Pony Express was a miniature communications revolution all to its own. For $5 an ounce, businesses could send and receive messages in half the time it took with normal mail. By day and night and through all types of weather, young riders and their speedy horses dashed between way stations and exchanged mail satchels. Although a stunning improvement over the old mail service, the Pony Express was a financial failure, sinking its investors into serious debt. After only 18 months of operation, by October 1861 and the completion of the Overland Telegraph, the Pony Express was forced out of business. Turning to items of interest in the news. Amid the ruckus and controversy surrounding Germany's new Holocaust memorial, film director Steven Spielberg recently offered up his extensive archive of interviews with Holocaust survivors. The memorial, now set to be a research center, exhibition space, and memorial park, has been the subject of parliamentary debate for more than a decade. Spielberg's offer hasn't been accepted yet. In other news, there's nothing like a sex scandal to boost the popularity of a president. Ever since recent DNA testing showed that Thomas Jefferson most likely fathered an illegitimate child with one of his black slaves, Sally Hemings, attendance at Jefferson's home has soared. In response to such increased interest in Jefferson and especially the lives of the slaves who surrounded him, the directors of Monticello have begun emphasizing the African culture that surrounded the president. With only 6 white people and over 200 African slaves on the plantation, Monticello really was a small African village. You are listening to Talking History. One of the hottest trouble spots in the world today is the Balkans, especially the area that once comprised the communist state of Yugoslavia. But then that part of the world has been a hot spot, the theater for ethnic violence and local welfare for centuries. Here to help us better understand that history since the collapse of the former Yugoslavia is Creighton Professor Jerry Clark, who will be talking to Susan Woodward.
Only some 50 years after the defeat of the German Third Reich, Europe is once again experiencing ethnic violence and genocide. The site of this tragedy is not surprisingly the Balkans. An ethnically heterogeneous and historically troubled region, the Balkans were at peace during the entire Soviet era. United in a communist federal state, Yugoslavia, the peoples of the Balkans had seemingly overcome much of their tragic history. However, even before the final collapse of the former Soviet Union, the region had once again flared in violence. Most of us are now familiar with the names and the places. Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and more recently, Kosovo. Here today to help us understand what lies behind the wars in the Balkans is Dr. Susan Woodward. Dr. Woodward is a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program of the Brookings Institution. She is the author of the book, Balkan Tragedy, Chaos and Dissolution After the Cold War. Welcome to our show, Dr. Woodward.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let me start with asking you a question to get a feel for the extent of the problem in the Balkans. Just how many wars and potential wars are being waged in the former Yugoslavia?
Well, happily, as we speak, only one semi-war is taking place, and that is in the province, autonomous province of Serbia, which is a part of Yugoslavia, and called Kosovo. And I say only semi-war because there are talks taking place at the moment in outside of Paris to try and prevent that from going further. But over the course of the period since 1990-91, this is the fourth war, and we could still have between, I think, maybe 3 to 5 more And even the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, which we hope was ended by the Dayton Peace Accord of 1995, could yet again reignite.
I see. During the Cold War, these people lived together in peace in a single federal state, Yugoslavia. What happened to Yugoslavia?
You know, I think people forget often how important a functioning government and the rule of law and order is. And in Yugoslavia, in the course of the 1980s, the same things took place that led to what we think of as the end of the Cold War. That is to say, the two are intertwined at two levels in Yugoslavia. One, they had to make major economic and political reforms in order to meet the terms to adjust to their foreign trade and borrowing accounts. And it failed. It was just simply too much for the system to bear, as we worry now in a place like Russia or Indonesia or even Brazil and Turkey. But secondly, Yugoslavia, like most countries, had a very special place in the Cold War system. That is to say, what we are as a country is in part determined by where we are geographically and geopolitically and our relationship to regional and international systems of power. And once the Cold War came to an end, that meant the end of the international system that had defined Yugoslavia and all the things that kept it together or had prevented people from trying other options of leaving fell apart.
I see. Most people I speak with about the problems in the former Yugoslavia tell me that the main cause of the violence is ethnic, that in essence the people groups of the Balkans learn nothing from their experience of living together. Do you agree?
Oh, not at all. I think you can look at many countries, the United States included, where people live very well together who are have very different interests and aspirations. But once the government stops functioning and people think that they can take advantage of the situation, you see amazing disagreements and even what people sometimes call hatreds. My view is that what we call ethnic conflict and ethnic hatred in the former Yugoslavia, whether Bosnia or Croatia or Slovenia or Kosovo, is the outcome of war and fear, not the cause.
So you're saying that the ethnic factor is not the primary cause of the wars in the Balkans. Instead, there appear to be two sets of factors here. Could you explain a little bit more to our audience about the domestic political factors that you see that are contributing to the violence?
You know, it's a very complicated story because any system to function in the modern world is very complicated. Many hidden assumptions about what we think is right and wrong, and many explicit ways in which the police and the courts and the legislatures and others function to keep us all following a set of rules. But in the early 1980s, the Yugoslavia had, because of a number of external factors and the price of their goods in the international market and the price of the dollar, which they used to buy things, the price of oil and so forth, found themselves with a much higher foreign debt than they thought. And it was what we call the time of the debt crisis, when commercial banks stopped lending because they thought that the Polish crisis, for example, and then the Latin American crisis and the difficulties in the Soviet Union meant they wouldn't be paid as much. And Yugoslavia found itself facing the International Monetary Fund and very, very strict rules of reform that it had to do in order to get new money to repay old debt and to buy new imports for their industry and for consumers. Over 10 years, it meant such a fundamental change in the system that many parts of the country not only fell apart, but in other parts, the wealthier areas, in particular Slovenia and Croatia, decided they would rather leave the country and go best on their own and sought independence.
You know, I find that in your answer an interesting idea that the international community is to some degree implicated in all of this. What particular international organizations and countries may have in fact facilitated the violence, and what might they have done to have done so?
Well, that's a big order, and let me say briefly that I think that the international financial institutions, particularly the International Monetary Fund, make requirements on countries that appear very technical and innocuous to improve the way their economies function and to pay debt back to banks, but in fact they have profound political consequences that can undermine all of the basis of social equality, social welfare, of political rules that keep elites functioning together rather than intensely fighting. We see this, as I say, in many places now. Worrisome are Indonesia and Russia, to take two examples. But no one ever then comes along with recommendations or aid to help the political transformation that has to be made overnight. The European Union also was trying to integrate faster. We see now with the new currency that they created, they were on the process of financial integration in the course of the 1980s. And in Yugoslavia, Slovenia in particular, the most wealthy and northwest corner republic of that federal system, began to worry that if it did not leave Yugoslavia, it would never get in to be a member of the European Union as the Cold War was ending. And the European Union didn't really do the kinds of things to reassure the Slovenes that Yugoslavia, if it stayed together, would get membership soon. But also the United States did not play a very good role, because in the United States had always been a patron of Yugoslavia's special form of communism that was very independent of Moscow and of the Russian and Soviet leaders. But by 1987, 1988, we said, well, the Cold War is about to be over. Yugoslavia's territorial integrity and independence and its defense system are no longer really important to our protection. So we stopped paying attention to them and really didn't assist the federal government in the transition the way it should have. And finally, I think most importantly of all, in a crisis in 1991, the intervention by the European states and by the United States really paid too much attention, in my view, to the claims of nationalists, that they had a right to independence, without thinking about the consequences for much more of the majority of the population in Yugoslavia who wanted their country to survive but didn't have the attention of those European states.
You know, as I look at the wars in the Balkans, I'm struck by the fact that they don't seem to have occurred at the same time. You know, you were talking about Slovenia, and they left first. Instead, these wars seem to have happened one after the other. Why is that the case?
Well, I think one of the things to note is the fact that first it was a small war in Slovenia, then a much bloodier and longer war in Croatia for independence, and a war that is still not really over in many ways between the three national groups in Bosnia about what kind of state they would have. That this could not have been an ethnic conflict, or you would have seen it happen all at once. This was a conflict about having independent states and where the borders of those states would be. When you have a country, an area of the world, as we see in the Caucasus or in the Middle East, for example, with Israel and Palestine and the Kurds in Iraq, Turkey, and so forth, the state borders that were drawn at the beginning of the century by the major powers were not contiguous with national borders. And so what you find is that as Yugoslavia began to fall apart, those who could leave early were those who were wealthiest and who had the greatest support from international patrons, Slovenia first and then Croatia. But as the country began to fall apart, then you begin to get each new territory looking for its own political solution, where the borders of the new states would be, whom would they get support from in the international community. We see in Kosovo, for example, now that for 9 years there has been a struggle over whether Kosovo should become an independent Albanian majority state or whether it really is a part of Serbia and is so essential to Serbian history. And the time that it has taken to go to war has been really the time that it took both sides to get the attention of the international community and not its ignorance. And we could still see, even though there was an effort to support the borders of the existing Macedonian state, we could still see that the attention to the Albanians in Kosovo, because there are also many Albanians in Macedonia, neighboring Macedonia, that might want to join an independent Kosovo, and that would then break apart Macedonia, that we could still get a war there because the international community is going piece by piece by piece instead of finding one whole solution to this one country that fell apart.
I see. So these are the other potential hotspots that you were talking about at the beginning of the interview.
That's right.
How do you see the future? I mean, you told us we could see 3 or possibly 5 more conflicts yet in this region. Is there any hope for peace here?
I think there's a great deal of hope for peace, but I think it comes back to the two causes I mentioned at the beginning of our interview, which is that both the domestic systems, these countries have to be able to form not only functioning democracies, but especially economic systems that can function in an internationalized economy. And the aid policies at the moment are not making them stable in that way. And secondly, and even more important, no country can exist unless and be stable and not have a tendency to fall apart or have wars with its neighbors if its international environment and its position in the international system is not clear and is not stable. And until the United States and the major European powers define what place these new states of the Balkans have in Europe, are they going to be members of the European Union? What role does NATO play to incorporate them? What kinds of relationships do these new countries have with each other where they used to be a part of one country? Until that happens, there will be no peace.
In the time that we have remaining, I have one last question of you here. Perhaps you could comment on whether or not NATO expansion eastward, with the exclusion of Russia, would be helpful for defining that position in the new European or world order that you've been describing for us.
The difficulty with NATO enlargement at the moment is it only wants to include those countries that are already stable and democratic and relatively successful economically, although the new members, the Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary, are not heading for good economic times. So we're not out of the woods even with those countries. But by drawing the border of Europe between those countries and the rest of Eastern Europe, even if we forget Russia for a moment, so that the former Yugoslav states, like the new Yugoslavia or Macedonia or Bosnia, plus Bulgaria, Romania, Slovakia, Ukraine, if they're left out, all that does is create the new problem of an insecure and uncertain environment for these countries about how they provide for each other, where are they members or not. So that I think that the enlargement of NATO is only creating a new basis for instability. And as we see in the behavior of NATO as an organization towards trying to restabilize and bring peace to the Balkans, that all they do is threaten force to pressure people to act in a way that is against their interests, and at the same time only act after violence has begun. I think that until NATO takes its mandate and its own mission of creating stability in Europe more seriously, that we will not see a happy future.
Dr. Woodward, this has been very informing, and I've had a great deal of fun with you today, and I thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. I enjoyed this very much.
You've been listening to Dr. Susan Woodward, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the book Balkan Tragedy, Chaos and Dissolution After the Cold War.
Following up on Terry Clark's conversation with Susan Woodward, our op-ed of the week also focuses on the war in the Balkans. It's been prepared for us by Rosma Karklins, professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
Lately, nationalism has a bad name. Often, the press reports incidents and describes it in a very negative way. However, as many concepts in political science, nationalism has many meanings. I'd like to emphasize that it has a constructive side as well. One saw that especially in the 19th century and also in the early 20th century when many empires were brought to their knees by national movements, for example, in the former Tsarist Empire and the Ottoman Empire. Also after World War II, nationalism led to the decolonization of what we know as the Third World. So nationalism can be a very constructive force in mobilizing people for democracy, for political involvement, and also often for political solidarity, because nationalism talks about the people, the nation, and helping them to develop. I would say that one of the recent examples is the breakup of the Soviet Union, where even though often, again, we heard about nationalism as a destructive force, it in fact was very closely linked to democracy, especially in the Baltic states and the Ukraine. There is a difference between what we have seen in the Baltic states or the Baltics and what we see lately in the Balkans. In the Balkans, as we know, there have been many ethnic conflicts and nationalism often has totally got out of hand. However, even then, I would say that it's not always nationalism per se, but rather the incitement by various communist leaders who do not wish to give up power. And then once you have violence, there's an escalation, which makes it very difficult to stop these incidents. So in my interpretation, nationalism is closely linked to self-rule, the defense of the interests of your own people. And in that context, it should also be emphasized that typically smaller nations and peoples understand each other very well. The Poles understand the Lithuanians or the Irish or other smaller peoples such as native peoples in South and North America. Nevertheless, nationalism is not just nationalism of minority peoples. Large nations also can be nationalistic in both a positive or negative sense. Let me emphasize the positive sense again. I think that nationalism can be very close to the concept of patriotism. It can mean the dedication to the prospering of one's own nation and people. It can focus on solidarity and talking about the will of the people. So in conclusion, the difference is whether the focus of a nationalist movement is on increasing the position of one's own nation or whether it is against another nation. If it is more against another, of course it is more destructive. But if it focuses on the own nation, often it can be a very constructive force.
You've been listening to Razma Karklins, Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Wars, whether they be in the Balkans or in the United States, mean prisoners of war. The National Prisoner of War Museum, our historic site of the week, is dedicated to such men and women in United States history. Here to tell you more about the museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The National Prisoner of War Museum is located in Georgia at the Andersonville National Historic Site, about 140 miles south of Atlanta. It offers exhibits of prisoners of war from all the wars together in one setting. It honors the more than 800,000 Americans ever held as prisoners of war. The 10,000-square-foot museum chronicles the American POW experience from the Revolutionary Wars to the Persian Gulf Wars. A visit to the museum can be an emotional one. The barracks-like building is laid out in a series of rooms that mimic the POW experience and traces the POW's journey from capture to life in camp and ultimate freedom. There are memorabilia, interactive exhibits, and oral histories, along with a 20-minute documentary, Echoes of Captivity, narrated by General Colin Powell.
Thank you, Cindy. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, news of recently opened or future films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else of a historical nature that may interest you. The National Museum of American History has just opened an exhibit called Communities in a Changing Nation, The Promise of 19th Century America. This permanent exhibit explores the excitement and dynamism of American life during the 1800s through the experiences of three communities, industrial era Bridgeport, Connecticut, the Jewish immigrant community of Cincinnati, Ohio, and African Americans living in Charleston, South Carolina. For further information, contact the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. And while you're at the museum, you might take in another exhibit, World War I, All May Apply, on enlisted women in World War I. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our show on the history of the swing era. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.